Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And first off today, we're going to look at the conflict or discussion, if you will, about daylight saving time. Should it be made permanent? Well, according to the Washington Post, it's time to lock the clock. Twice yearly, people across the U.S. go through the same stupid ritual that leaves us groggy and out of sorts, moving the clocks forward in March for daylight saving, and then moving them back again for standard time in November. Last week, though, the Senate unanimously approved a measure that would put an end to the century of back and forth and make daylight saving time permanent across the country. And if the House also passes the bill and President Biden signs it, well, is that good or not good? Well, according to the New York Magazine, they say, hallelujah. As one senator said after introducing the Sunshine Protection Act, permanent daylight saving would give us an extra hour of afternoon sunshine in the winter, encouraging people to shop and to eat out, to be active, and it would boost the economy. That's always sort of a key word or phrase, isn't it? It means that we can drop the tradition, according to this senator, of pointlessly resetting our clocks twice a year and disrupting our sleep cycles. Well, not all people agree with him, and I thought I'd give you several responses to this. And one is from the Scientific American, where there is an article saying, this isn't about having to deal with a bit of pre-dawn gloom. Losing out on the hour of morning sun that comes with daylight saving can have far-reaching health effects. Our circadian rhythms are finely tuned to exposure to sunlight. And morning sunlight falling on our optic nerve halts melatonin production, and it triggers wakefulness. Starting the day in hours of darkness can make you feel like you have jet lag, and being out of sync has been linked to an increased risk of depression, obesity, and even heart disease. Seems a bit strong there to me, but I'm going to give you still another view from the Atlantic magazine, which says, make standard time permanent. It would end the irritating clock changing, and standard time is the natural solution that gives people plenty of early sunlight. Our bodies already want to follow the sun. Our clocks should do the same. And then finally, on NPR, National Public Radio, they say, and what? Have the sunrise at 4:30 a.m. in New York in June, wasting hours of sunlight? This is the problem with a country as large as the U.S. There is no universally popular solution. And in the end, there's only so much daylight to go around. The best solution, according to NPR, is to do nothing at all. The current system, daylight saving in the summer and standard time in the winter, may not be perfect, but it's the product of decades of study and compromise. And Congress meddles with that at its peril. Well, what do you think? Do you have a feeling about this? Are you anti or for? Well, we'll find out. And now, on to our second item in just a moment or two. We're back again, and I don't know if you've noticed, but hurricanes are fewer than they used to be, but they're a lot stronger. La Nina, which is the opposite condition of El Nino, brings quiet, but damage rises with people. What do I mean by that? Well, that's the basis of this article. Hurricanes and the storms like them around the planet have been decreasing worldwide over the past 10 years or so. But at the same time, the damage they cause has been increasing. Why have hurricanes been decreasing? Well, you can give thanks to La Nina. Attribute this decreasing global trend to the shift toward a more La Nina-like basic state in the overall tropical climate. La Nina increases Atlantic hurricane activity. It tends to decrease Pacific hurricane activity and the storms that are like hurricanes, but called other things like typhoons and cyclones. Since the Pacific generates much more activity than the Atlantic climatologically, La Nina tends to reduce global storm activity. Remember now, the La Nina climate pattern is a natural cycle. It's marked by cooler than average ocean water in the Central Pacific Ocean. And its counterpart, then, El Nino, is a cycle where the ocean waters in the Central Pacific are warmer than usual and move toward the South American and Central American coasts. Well, the pattern is one of the main drivers of weather in the United States and around the world, especially during the late fall, in the winter, and in the early spring. During a La Nina cycle, the Atlantic hurricane season tends to be more active and the Pacific season is usually much quieter. Although there may be fewer tropical cyclones, which is the umbrella term for hurricanes, typhoons, and so forth, the damage they cause is increasing, basically because we have more valuable things in the way. A significant increase in global damage caused by tropical cyclones primarily is due to growth in population and wealth along the coastline. The largest increase in global damage, therefore, is the Atlantic. That is somewhat to be expected, given that the Atlantic has the largest financial exposure to hurricanes. This would include coastal areas of the United States, from Florida north to New England. For example, while the Atlantic only had 11% of the global total of the strongest hurricanes, the fours and the fives in strength, during the study period, over 60% of the global damage from tropical storms occurred in the Atlantic. Researchers find that there is an increase in storms that intensified by 60 miles per hour or more in 24 hours. And this is likely because of the warmer sea surface temperatures. And some of this increase in intensity is tied, of course, to climate change-related warming. The number of strong hurricanes also is increasing. While the trend is not statistically significant, there is an increasing trend in the percentage of hurricanes that reach the strongest category, the category fours and the category fives. These are the most intense storms with wind speeds of at least 130 miles per hour. And they can produce catastrophic damage. Well, the change toward potentially fewer storms but more strong storms is directly in line with what climate models are projecting with continued climate change. And as time passes, this will probably become more clear. And with that, we pause for a moment or two, and we'll be back with item number three for today. I want to tell you now a little bit about how war in Ukraine is threatening global food security. When Ukraine banned the export of wheat in March and started scattering landmines in fields of winter cereals and sunflowers in order to slow invading Russian troops, it was bad news for Egyptian families who were struggling to put food on the table. Egypt, which counts on Ukraine and Russia for half of its food imports, was already facing food supply disruptions and high prices as a result of the COVID pandemic and some climate-related production issues and losses. But now, Russia's war in Ukraine has sent prices of grains and cooking oils even higher in the Cairo markets, and a trend is that if this is sustained, it could put new strains on the social fabric of the country. Global food inventories before the war were already low, even lower than 2007 and 2008 when we had the last big food price crisis. But this war is occurring in what is called the breadbasket for North Africa and the Middle East. And while we're not going to have famine in Egypt, we could see unpredictable and destabilizing consequences across the region. Over the past two decades, Ukraine and Russia together have made the Black Sea region a global food powerhouse. They account for nearly 30% of global wheat exports. Some 26 countries now depend on Ukraine and Russia for more than 50% of their grains and oils. In the sweep of modern history, Ukraine's transition from the forced mass starvation at the hands of Soviet Russia in the 1930s that killed an estimated 3.5 million Ukrainians to become a major purveyor of global food security is an astounding accomplishment. But now, Ukraine's sudden war-induced withdrawal from global food supply chains, as well as stalled grain exports from Russia, have the experts warning of a new round of food insecurity and weakening price hikes that were reminiscent of the food price crisis that accompanied the global financial meltdown of 2007 and 2008. The two countries are also major exporters of agricultural fertilizers. Ukraine's disrupted fertilizer production, along with war-related sanctions on Russian farm products, will raise farmers' costs globally. There is hope that other major food-producing countries will be pitching in by maintaining or even increasing their export stocks, and that they avoid protectionist measures. So far, global trade analysts say they are encouraged by an absence of any significant food export controls that countries may use to backstop their own food prices. While no one anticipates food price protests sweeping across developing countries in the short term, many countries, including Egypt, have at least modest food subsidies to cushion rising prices. A more immediate concern is the impact that skyrocketing food prices will have on humanitarian aid efforts to countries that are already experiencing food insecurity, which is worsening, such as Yemen, Afghanistan, and the southern Sudan. This is indeed a problem that we need to keep our eye on, be very watchful, and see what happens in the next few months. You're enjoying the music today, but we're going to pause the music and go on with another item entitled Schedulers Are Stumbling Over What Next Week Really Means. If today is Monday, when is next Sunday? What about if today is Friday or also a Sunday? Many appointments have been missed and many planners have been frustrated because the answer is not always the same, though theoretically it should be. Next means immediately adjacent, as in place, rank, or time. So whether it's Monday, April the 4th, or Friday, April the 8th, or Sunday, April the 3rd, immediately adjacent is where it should be. It should be April the 10th. But that's much too easy for the English language and its speakers, though. Because next Sunday could also be April 17th as well, or beyond that. The answer varies with geography. And so, as you travel, keep abreast of what the local expressions actually mean. Know the trend where you are. Because if you're in Scotland or Northern Ireland, much of the U.S., and next week, the phrase next week is likely to mean one thing. When you're somewhere else, it could be something entirely different. So that's an idea I wanted to introduce today and have you think about it. What does next week mean to you where you live? And we'll come back to it in another program. But then we have a number of small items that deserve attention. In a category which might be labeled, this happens only in America, business should avoid using the word competitive in job postings because it might deter women from applying, according to the Harvard Business Review. That publication urges the use of neutral language so as not to scare off applicants, citing terms such as blacklisted and man hours as being racist and sexist, respectively. You have to think about that. And then there's a partisan battle which has broken out over chocolate milk. In upstate New York, a representative from there who represents an upstate district with dairy farms introduced a bill that would require schools in the federal lunch program to offer students at least one flavored milk option. But New York's new mayor, who's a vegan, has called for banning chocolate milk in Big Apple schools, noting that it's loaded with sugar and feeds our healthcare crisis. Only in America. Well, last week was a good week for vacationing in Antarctica, where the temperature soared to 70 degrees above average and shattered all previous records. Meanwhile, parts of the Arctic were more than 50 degrees warmer than average, with ice nearing the melting point months earlier. Good week if you're vacationing there, I guess. Good week for composting. After the first person in Colorado was laid to rest, with the remains converted to soil as a greener alternative to cremation. Well, in the process of natural reduction, the deceased corpse decomposed over 6 months in a chamber with wood chips, alfalfa, straw, and microbes. I like to think about that. And finally, galactic ambition. Good week for that. After a candidate for the governorship of Georgia, Stacey Abrams, she said she was an avowed Trekkie, and she donned a robe and played the president of United Earth in a new episode of Star Trek Discovery. On the other hand, it was a bad week for Miami Beach, which declared a state of emergency after tens of thousands of unruly spring breakers took over the city, brawling, firing guns, and stampeding. This isn't your father or your mother's spring break, said the mayor. Trouble in Miami. Well, we're nearing the end of today's show. And in the near future, we're going to be talking about Moderna and the need for a second booster shot. We'll come back and talk about what next week means. And another thing that I'd like to contribute is a decoding of supplement labels. When you buy vitamins and other supplements at the your local drugstore, how do you decode the labeling? To what extent is it authoritative and approved by the government? And what information is really accurate, or what, and what kinds of information should be there but isn't? So that's ahead for us, along with a number of other interesting topics I hope you'll find. And time now for me to say goodbye, and hope you keep yourself safe, stay well. Remember, I always say, be kind to each other, because people will be surprised, and it's good for all of us. In the meantime, Willie Nelson and I, once again, head down the road looking for items to put into next week's program of A Little of This, A Little of That, on 101.5 on your dial. Remember that we're now on in the evening, and it's 7:30. Check the schedule for the change. Willie, time to take us home. Let's hit the road again.